This CLE is based on the appellate decisions addressing issues in civil procedure released in September 2019. The summaries of these decisions were initially posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in September 2019 and have since been compiled into a September 2019 civil procedure pamphlet, update pamphlet. And it is that pamphlet that serves as the written materials for the CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is Rosenfeld on page 5. It has to do with the requirements of a 90-day notice. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the action was not properly dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3216, and plaintiff's motion to restore the action to the calendar should have been granted. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court issued a certification order which certified the matter for trial and directed the plaintiff to file a notice of issue within 90 days. The order provided that if plaintiff does not file a notice of a note of issue within 90 days, this action may be dismissed," and then it cited CPLR 3216. Thereafter, the parties executed a stipulation extending the date by which the note of issue must be filed. Then the action was ministerially dismissed without further notice to the parties. The court wrote, "An action cannot be dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3216A unless a written demand is served upon the party against whom such relief is sought in accordance with the statutory requirements, along with a statement that the default by the party upon whom such notice is served in complying with such demand within said 90-day period will serve as a basis for a motion by the party serving said demand for dismissal as against him for unreasonably neglecting to proceed." The certification order, which purported to serve as a 90-day notice pursuant to CPLR 3216, was defective as it did not state that plaintiff's failure to comply with the demand would serve as a basis for the court on its own motion to dismiss the action for failure to prosecute. Furthermore, contrary to the determination of the Supreme Court, the subsequent stipulation, which purported to extend the plaintiff's deadline for filing a note of issue, did not constitute a valid 90-day demand. So to reiterate, the certification order only said that if plaintiff does not file a note of issue within 90 days, this action may be dismissed. The certification order did not include language saying that the party serving the 90-day notice could make a motion to dismiss, and it didn't say that the court could make its own motion to dismiss if a note of issue was not filed within 90 days, and that was therefore the certification order was not a valid substitute for the statutory 90-day notice. Next is Meisner v. Hamilton Fulton Montgomery Board of Cooperative Educational Services. It's on page 6. It has to do with the issues related to bringing in Article 78. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the court should have considered defendants' affirmative defenses, including the statute of limitations defense, in determining defendants' summary judgment motion. Plaintiff had brought a fraud, breach of contract, and prima facie tort causes of action against defendant. Plaintiff was enrolled in defendant's licensed practical nurse program and was dismissed by defendant based upon plaintiff's performance in the clinical setting. The Third Department held that the action should have been brought in an Article 78, and because it wasn't brought within the four-month time period, it was time-barred. The court wrote, "Supreme Court should have considered defendants' affirmative defenses on the summary judgment motion. Although the notice of motion did not cite CPLR 3211A, it did seek dismissal of the complaint in its entirety, as well as such other and further relief as the court deemed just and proper. And defendant's memorandum of law, submitted with the motion, addressed dismissal based on the statute of limitations and failure to exhaust administrative remedies, thereby providing plaintiff with adequate notice of these bases for the motion. A defendant may raise an affirmative defense listed in CPLR 3211A in a pre-answer motion to dismiss, or, for most of those grounds, may instead choose to raise that defense in its answer and either move on that ground later in a motion for summary judgment or wait until trial to have it determined. Plaintiff's separate causes of action sounding in breach of contract, fraud, and prima facie tort are all, at their core, challenges to defendant's actions in dismissing her from the nursing program in a manner that allegedly was not in good faith and was without sound factual basis, rendering her dismissal arbitrary and capricious. Therefore, she should have brought her challenge in an Article 78 proceeding. And because this proceeding was not timely under the four-month statute, the entire action was time-barred. Next is the Gretschko case. On pages 8 and 9, it deals with the dead man statute. Second Department, reversing the defense verdict in this medical malpractice case and ordering a new trial, held that hearsay statements to the effect that plaintiff's decedent had signed an against medical advice, or AMA form, when he allegedly refused treatment at defendant hospital were not admissible under the dead man statute or as statements against interest or admissions or as business records. The court wrote, a hearsay entry in a hospital record is admissible under the business records exception to the hearsay rule if the entry is germane to the diagnosis or treatment of the patient, citing CPLR 4518A. Here, although the entries were germane to the decedent's diagnosis and treatment, the defendants failed to offer foundational testimony under CPLR 4518A or certification under CPLR 4518C. If an entry in the medical records is inconsistent with the position taken by a party at trial, it is admissible as an admission by that party, even if it is not germane to the diagnosis or treatment, as long as there is evidence connecting the party to the entry. Here, the entry clearly states that the decedent's primary care physician, not the decedent himself, was the source of the information. Pursuant to CPLR 4519, otherwise known as the dead man statute, upon the trial of an action, a party or a person interested in the event shall not be examined as a witness in his or her own behalf or interest against the executor, administrator, or survivor of a deceased person or the committee of a mentally ill person concerning a personal transaction or communication between the witness and the deceased person or mentally ill person. Here, both witnesses were defendants at the time they gave deposition testimony, making them interested parties under the statute, and they both testified to transactions or communications with the decedent and sought to offer that testimony against the decedent's estate. Contrary to the defendant's contention, the declaration of the decedent did not fall within the declaration against interest exception to the hearsay rule, because the defendants failed to establish that the subject statement was against the decedent's interest when made. Moreover, where the dead man statute renders a witness's testimony inadmissible, the fact that the testimony would fall within an exception to the hearsay rule is simply irrelevant. Next is the U.S. Bank National Association case on page 9. It's another case dealing with the 90-day notice, and this time deals with whether a conditional order of dismissal can serve as a valid 90-day notice. Second Department held the conditional order upon which dismissal of the complaint was based was not authorized because issue had not been joined at the time the order was made. Therefore, the bank's motion to vacate the conditional order in this foreclosure action should have been granted. And the court also found that an unauthorized supplemental record on appeal, which was stipulated to by the parties, contained material that wasn't in the record, and therefore the appellate court did not consider that supplemental record on appeal. With regard to the 90-day notice, the court wrote, a pleading cannot be dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3216A unless a written demand is served upon the party against whom such relief is sought in accordance with the statutory requirements, along with a statement that the default by the party upon whom such notice is served in complying with such demand within said 90-day period will serve as a basis for a motion by a party serving said demand for dismissal against him for unreasonably neglecting to proceed. While a conditional order of dismissal may have the same effect as a valid 90-day notice pursuant to CPLR 3216, the conditional order here was defective in that it did not state the plaintiff's failure to comply with the notice will serve as a basis for a motion by the court to dismiss the complaint for failure to prosecute. So the conditional order did not serve as a 90-day notice because of the language of the order and what was left out of it. And also, the conditional order was not effective because issue was not joined at the time the conditional order was issued. Next is the DeJesus case on page 10. Has to do with the evidence that can be submitted at an inquest, Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that although defendant's answer in this slip and fall case had been struck, the defendant should not have been precluded from presenting evidence on damages. The court said, Supreme Court struck the answer and scheduled an inquest on the issue of damages. At the inquest, following direct testimony by the plaintiff, the court denied defense counsel's request to cross-examine the plaintiff, since the defendant's answer had been stricken. The court awarded the plaintiff damages in the principal sum of $267,221. A defendant whose answer is stricken as a result of a default admits all traversable allegations in the complaint, including the basic allegation of liability, but does not admit the plaintiff's conclusion as to damages. Accordingly, where a judgment against a defaulting defendant is sought by motion to the court, the defendant is entitled, at an inquest, to determine damages, to cross-examine witnesses, give testimony, and offer proof in mitigation of damages. Next is the Triadou case, T-R-I-A-D-O-U. It's on pages 10 and 11. It has to do with a court-monitored escrow account, and the question was whether post-judgment interest could be collected when the money had been placed in a court-monitored escrow account. First Department held that the deposit of full payment of the judgments placed in a court-monitored escrow account were subject to the accrual of post-judgment interest. The court said, contrary to defendants' arguments, the payment to the monitorship account was not a deposit to the court, as it was not pursuant to an order of the court made upon motion, that CPLR 5021 subdivision A3. Rather, under the circumstances, the monitorship account functioned simply as an escrow account while the defendants continued to oppose plaintiff's claims and pursue their own. Therefore, post-judgment interest accrued on the account. Next is the Zalesniak case on page 11. It has to do with personal jurisdiction. Second Department held defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction was properly granted. The defendant alleged he was not served with the summons and complaint within 120 days of filing, and plaintiff had not filed an affidavit of service with the clerk of the court. The court wrote, while the failure to timely file an affidavit of service with the clerk, as required by CPLR 308 subdivision 4, may, in the absence of prejudice, be corrected by court order pursuant to CPLR 2004. In this case, the plaintiff failed to seek such relief, and the Supreme Court declined to extend this time sua sponte. Accordingly, we agree with the court's determination to grant that branch of his motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 3211A8, to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against him on the ground of lack of personal jurisdiction. So the failure to file the affidavit of service within 120 days in combination with the defendant's allegation that he was never served with the summons and complaint justified the dismissal of the case. Next is Estate of Norman Perlman, which is on page 12. It's another jurisdiction case. Second Department held plaintiff's failure to timely mail a copy of the summons and complaint after serving the documents at defendant's place of business was a jurisdictional defect, which could not be cured by late mailing. Court wrote, a mailing sent with the wrong time frame, like a mailing sent by the wrong method, increases the likelihood that a party will not receive proper notice of a legal proceeding. The first 20-day window set forth in CPLR 308 subdivision 2 serves an important function. If the delivery and mailing required by that statute are not made within a short time of one another, there is a greater likelihood that one or both sets of pleadings will be mislaid, or at the very least, that confusion will arise as to how much time the defendant has to respond, both of which appear to have occurred here. Further, the requirement that an affidavit of service be filed within 20 days of the delivery or mailing, whichever is effected later, also serves an important function. Timely filing of the affidavit of service is designed to give notice as to the plaintiff's claim of service and permit the defendant to calculate the time to answer. So to reiterate, the failure to timely mail a copy of the summons and complaint after having served the documents at the defendant's place of business was a jurisdictional defect. Next is the Aybar case, A-Y-B-A-R, on pages 12 and 13, another jurisdiction case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that Goodyear's motion to dismiss the product's liability complaint for lack of jurisdiction should have been granted. Plaintiff, a New York resident, was injured when a tire manufactured by Goodyear allegedly malfunctioned, causing the car to overturn in Virginia. The Second Department held that plaintiff did not rebut Goodyear's argument that it did not have significant affiliations with New York, and noted that a corporation's registration with the New York State Department of State does not confer jurisdiction in New York. The court wrote, the plaintiff failed to make a prima facie showing that personal jurisdiction over Goodyear existed under CPLR 301. The plaintiff did not rebut the evidence submitted by Goodyear showing that Goodyear's affiliations with New York are not so continuous and systematic as to render it essentially at home here. Furthermore, contrary to the Supreme Court's determination, a corporate defendant's registration to do business in New York and designation of the Secretary of State to accept service of process in New York does not constitute consent by the corporation to submit to the general jurisdiction of New York for causes of action that are unrelated to the corporation's affiliations with New York. Next is the Hulse case, H-U-L-S-E, on pages 13 and 14. It's another jurisdiction case, but it also involves the sua sponte action by a judge, which was criticized. The Second Department, modifying Supreme Court, held that the judge should not have raised sua sponte issues not raised by the parties in granting defendants, that's the Worths, motion to dismiss the complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction. The process server filed an affidavit saying that the summons and complaint had been timely mailed to the defendants. The affidavit did not state that the envelope was marked personal and confidential, or that the envelope indicated it was from an attorney. There was no proof the envelope was not properly marked, and the defendants had not raised these issues. The defendants merely asserted they never received the mailing. Second Department also held the amended complaint, adding additional parties, was a nullity because the court did not grant leave to amend. The court wrote, given that the Worths argued that they did not receive the summons and complaint in the mail, Supreme Court should not have determined, sua sponte, that jurisdiction was not acquired over the Worths because the process server did not attest that the mailed copies of the summons and complaint were contained in an envelope bearing the legend personal and confidential, and not indicating on the outside thereof that the communication is from an attorney or concerns an action against the person to be served, citing CPLR 308 subdivision 2. Courts are not in the business of blindsiding litigants who expect the courts to decide issues on rationales advanced by the parties, not arguments that were never made. By raising the CPLR 302 subdivision 2 envelope requirement on its own, the court deprived the plaintiffs of the opportunity to show compliance with that requirement. Next is Abco Music on pages 14 and 15. It's another jurisdiction case, First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the Ohio trustee's request for payment under a 1986 royalty agreement with the New York plaintiff did not confer jurisdiction upon New York, even though the contract included a New York choice of law provision. The court wrote, the trustee's requests from Ohio by letter, telephone, or email to plaintiff in New York to send him monies due under the royalty agreement that plaintiff had entered into in 1986 with non-party Denise Somerville, which would merely continue plaintiff's previous practice of sending royalties to Somerville in Ohio, do not constitute the transaction of business under CPLR 302 subdivision A1. Negotiating a contract from outside New York is insufficient to constitute the transaction of business in New York. The fact that the contract chooses New York law does not constitute a voluntary submission to personal jurisdiction in New York. Next is Mid-Island Mortgage Corporation on pages 15 and 16. It's another jurisdiction case, this time involving due diligence by the process server. Second Department held personal jurisdiction was not obtained over defendant in this foreclosure action. The process server, who used the affix and mail method of service, was aware the defendant was in the military. The court wrote, service pursuant to CPLR 308 subdivision 4, known as affix and mail service, may be used only where service under CPLR 308 subdivision 1 or subdivision 2 cannot be made with due diligence. While the precise manner in which due diligence is to be accomplished is not rigidly prescribed, the requirement that due diligence be exercised must be strictly observed, given the reduced likelihood that a summons served pursuant to CPLR 308 subdivision 4 will be received. A mere showing of several attempts at service at either a defendant's residence or place of business may not satisfy the due diligence requirement before resort to affix and mail service. Due diligence may be satisfied with a few visits on different occasions at different times to the defendant's residence or place of business when the defendant could reasonably be expected to be found at that location at those times. According to the affidavit of service and the process server's in-house work order sheet, the process server knew that the defendant was in the active military service. Since the process server was aware that the defendant was engaged in active military service at the time the process server attempted service at the address, the process server's four attempts at service prior to resorting to affix and mail service were not made when the defendant could reasonably be expected to be found at that location. Next is Board of Managers on page 16. It has to do with pleading requirements where fraudulent conveyance is alleged. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that because a fraudulent conveyance action does not require an intent to defraud, the specificity requirement in the CPLR for pleading a fraud cause of action does not apply. Here, plaintiff alleged the defective design and construction of a condominium. The court wrote, pursuant to debtor and creditor law, section 273, a conveyance that renders the conveyor insolvent is fraudulent as to creditors without regard to actual intent, if the conveyance was made without fair consideration, citing debtor and creditor law, section 273. Pursuant to debtor and creditor law, section 274, a conveyance is fraudulent as to creditors without regard to actual intent when it is made without fair consideration when the person making it is engaged or is about to engage in a business or transaction for which the property remaining in his or her hands after the conveyance is an unreasonably small capital. Since valid claims of violations of debtor and creditor law sections 273 and 274 do not require proof of actual intent to defraud, such claims are not required to be pleaded with particularity, with the particularity required by CPLR 3016 subdivision B. Next is AMBAC Assurance Corporation on page 17. It deals with the law of privilege and whether the law of privilege in another state is applicable in a New York action. First Department held a privilege under Wisconsin law protected certain emails and documents generated in a Wisconsin action by the Wisconsin Commissioner of Insurance concerning the payment of insurance claims stemming from the issuance of residential mortgage-backed securities. The decision doesn't explain the underlying facts, but here's what it said with regard to the law. New York courts routinely apply the law of the place where the evidence in question will be introduced at trial or the location of the discovery proceeding when deciding privilege issues. However, there are circumstances in which an interest balancing analysis is properly undertaken to decide whether another state's law should govern the evidentiary privilege. This is a case that presents such circumstances. So there are situations in which the another state's law of privilege would apply to a New York action. Unfortunately, this case does not explain the underlying facts. Next is Brito, B-R-I-T-O, versus Gomez on page 18, another privilege case. The Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division, held plaintiff had placed the condition of her knees into controversy in this accident case, and the defendants were therefore entitled to discovery with respect to prior treatment of her knees. Again, the facts were not discussed. The court wrote, plaintiff affirmatively placed the condition of her knees into controversy through allegations that the underlying accident caused difficulty in walking and standing that affect her ambulatory capacity and resultant damages. Under the particular circumstances of this case, plaintiff therefore waived the physician-patient privilege with respect to the prior treatment of her knees and the discovery sought by authorizations pertaining to the treatment of plaintiff's knees is material and necessary to defendant's defense of the action, citing CPLR 3101 subdivision A. Accordingly, Supreme Court erred in denying defendant's motion to compel plaintiff to provide discovery related to the prior treatment of her knees. Next is Bayview Loan Servicing on pages 18 and 19. It's a foreclosure case and it deals with a standing issue that often comes up in foreclosure actions. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion pursuant to CPLR 3124 to compel the bank in this foreclosure action to produce the original note and endorsements should have been granted. Defendant had challenged the bank's standing to bring the foreclosure action, and the production of the original note and endorsements was material and necessary to resolve the standing question. The court said, it is undisputed that a copy of the underlying note was annexed to the complaint. However, it cannot be ascertained from the copy of the note provided by the plaintiff whether the separate page that bears the endorsement in blank was stamped on the back of the note, as alleged by the plaintiff, or on an allonge, and if on an allonge, whether the allonge was so firmly affixed as to become part thereof, as required under UCC 3-202, subdivision 2. Next is QNO Estates Corporation on page 20, another foreclosure action, which involves a standing issue and also the statute of limitations. The Second Department held plaintiff's action to cancel and discharge a mortgage on the ground the statute of limitations for a foreclosure action had expired was properly dismissed. So here plaintiff was seeking to cancel and discharge a mortgage because the time for bringing a foreclosure action had passed. Although the bank had attempted to foreclose in 2008, the action had been dismissed for lack of standing. Therefore, the debt was not accelerated by the 2008 foreclosure proceeding. So the takeaway here is, even though bringing a foreclosure action generally accelerates the debt and therefore starts the statute of limitations, if the bank did not have standing to bring the foreclosure action and the action was dismissed on that ground, then the debt was never accelerated and the statute of limitations never started to run. Next is the Wesolowski case on page 21. It's another statute of limitations case, this time involving the statutes of limitation for medical malpractice versus negligence. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint on statute of limitations grounds should not have been granted. Plaintiff's decedent's injuries were alleged to relate to defendant hospital's improper restraint of plaintiff's decedent, apparently to keep him from getting up from his hospital bed. The defendant argued the 2.5-year statute of limitations for medical malpractice actions had passed. The Second Department held that the defendant did not demonstrate that a doctor had ordered the restraints. Therefore, the defendant had not made out a prima facie case that the action sounded in medical malpractice as opposed to negligence. So obviously the longer 3-year statute applied and the case was not dismissed. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be included in your attorney affirmation. The verification code for this September 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is UNIFIED. Again, the verification code for this September 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is UNIFIED. And finally, the last case is the Castro case on pages 23 and 24. And it has to do with the discretion, at least in the Second Department, for courts to order unified trials of both liability and damages. Second Department, setting aside the defense verdict on liability and ordering a new trial, held that the trial judge had the discretion to order and should have ordered a unified trial for both liability and damages in this Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6, Section 200, and Common Law Negligence Action. Plaintiff Castro alleged the elevated work platform he was on collapsed and he fell 6 or 7 feet to the ground. There were no witnesses to the incident. Plaintiff alleged brain, head, shoulder, and spine injuries. The defense alleged plaintiff was injured moving planks and did not, in fact, fall. Evidence of any brain injury was excluded from the trial. Because the evidence of brain injury was consistent with a fall and inconsistent with moving planks, the exclusion of that evidence affected the fairness of the trial. This opinion made it clear that judges in the Second Department have the discretion to order unified trials in personal injury actions. The court wrote, "Here, by any standard, a unified trial was warranted. Labor Law Section 240 Subdivision 1 imposes on owners or general contractors and their agents a non-delegable duty and absolute liability for injuries proximately caused by the failure to provide appropriate safety devices to workers who are subject to elevation-related risks. Defendants disputed the plaintiff's claim that Castro fell from a scaffold and contended that the accident resulted not from an elevation-related risk, but from Castro's action in lifting wooden planks. Evidence relating to Castro's brain injuries, which would not have occurred from lifting wooden planks, was probative in determining how the incident occurred. Thus, the nature of the injuries had an important bearing on the issue of liability. The Supreme Court did not exercise its available discretion in denying the plaintiff's motion for a unified trial. The court's determination was predicated upon its perception that a bifurcated trial was strictly required by the Second Department's rules. However, neither the statewide rule nor the governing precedent absolutely requires that the trial of a personal injury action be bifurcated. Although bifurcation is encouraged in appropriate settings, bifurcation is not an absolute given, and it is the responsibility of the trial judge to exercise discretion in determining whether bifurcation is appropriate in light of all relevant facts and circumstances presented by the individual cases. Because the issues of liability and Castro's injuries were so intertwined, the court's insistence upon bifurcation and its ensuing limitations on the scope of the medical evidence that could be elicited by the plaintiffs deprived them of a fair trial. So this concludes the September 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE.